This is James Hollis, Friday, November 14th, 2008. Why Good People Do Bad Things, Revisiting the Shadow.
Thank you very much. Hardworking also means probably the most neurotic Jungian in the country, too. So I'm pleased to be back in Seattle, especially between rain showers, as it were, as I've heard you've had a few. This weekend, we're going to be looking at one of Jung's most central concepts, one that people have heard of, read about, thought about, and it almost becomes a kind of cliché. And at the same time, it seems to me the idea of the shadow is not only profound and radical, but so complex that we need to continue to revisit it. And tonight, what I'll try to do is lay out some basic definitions, give you some examples. And tomorrow, in our workshop, we'll try to look at different ways in which the shadow shows up, ranging from our culture to our psychology to the ways in which we relate to each other, interpersonal relationships. And then in the second half tomorrow, we'll be looking at aspects of the personal shadow. And you can see the shadow is already protesting by these hammer blows from the basement. So, consciousness is up here, but the unconscious is knocking about down there. And you can be sure that the unconscious will be heard this evening. As a matter of fact, if you were to hear rustling in your basement, if you felt there were little critters down there, would you really want to go down and find out what's there? Would you want to encounter whoever or whatever is down there? And if you did, and what you encountered down there were aspects of yourself, how pleasing would that be? So we all have rustling things, and tonight we have knocking things in our basement. There's a wonderful poem by Maxine Kuhman called Woodchucks, which takes this basic metaphor and explores it. So let me share that poem with you. Woodchucks. Gassing the woodchucks didn't turn out right. The knockout bomb from the feed and grain exchange was featured as merciful, quick at the bone, and the case we had against them was airtight. Both exits were shoehorned shut with pudding stone, but they had a sub-sub-basement out of sight. Next morning, they turned up again, no worse for the cyanide than we for our cigarettes and state store scotch, all of us up to scratch. They brought down the marigolds as a matter of course, and then took over the vegetable patch, nipping the broccoli shoots, beheading the carrots. The food from our mouths, I said, righteously thrilling to the feel of the 22, the bullets' neat noses. I, a lapsed pacifist fallen from grace, puffed with Darwinian pieties for killing, now drew a bead on the littlest woodchuck's face. He died down in the ever-bearing roses. 10 minutes later, I dropped the mother. She flip-flopped in the air and fell, her needle teeth still hooked in a leaf of early Swiss chard. Another baby next, oh, 1, 2, 3. The murder inside me rose up hard. The hawk-eyed killer came on stage forthwith. But there's one chuck left. Wily old fellow, he keeps me cocked and ready day after day after day. All night I hunt his humped-up form. I dream my sight along the barrel in my sleep. If only they'd all consented to die unseen, gassed underground, the good old Nazi way. Well, this is a poem that begins innocently enough and soon has its hooks in us. And we begin to realize this is a person who's begun to find things about herself that might, in fact, be contradictory with her self-image or her professed values. And at the same time, there are always rationalizations, puffed with Darwinian pieties. You know, after all, we are the superior race, aren't we? Aren't we the master race? Where does that lead us? A lapsed pacifist. Well, I'm a pacifist, but at the same time, there are exceptions. The food from our mouths. Not to mention the certain thrill that comes from this, too. There's a certain energy there. So what we see is that Maxine Kuhnman has backed us into the idea of the shadow. Now, the shadow is not to be considered synonymous with evil, though many times we talk about the shadow producing evil, as indeed it does. The shadow represents those aspects of ourselves or of our group or of our society that make us uncomfortable with ourselves when brought to the surface, which represent contradictions with our professed values, or as Jung said so succinctly, the things we do not wish to be, and yet there we are. Now that poem causes resonance because it begins to touch the basement of each of us. And the shadow, you see, is not something we can solve, cure, or avoid, because the shadow also involves to some degree the totality, or at least other aspects of our totality. Because part of the problem of human psychology is we can only see the world that we can see. In other words, we can only see from the limited purview of consciousness. How do we even know there's an unconscious? We don't know. It's a supposition. The one thing you couldn't possibly address is of what are you unconscious? Because we don't know. But when certain events occur over and over, or certain things spill into our lives, our relationships, our culture, then we begin to work backwards and say, well, somewhere that came from me. It's like the time someone complained to Freud about the contents of his dream, and he said, I don't claim any responsibility for that dream. And Freud said, well, whose dream do you think it is? So we'd have to say, all right, as working backwards here, not only do we have a basement, but it's dynamic and active, and it's spilling into the world consciously, or into consciousness all the time. Now, excuse me just a moment. I had a cold this week, and I think I'm no longer toxic to the world, but I had stuff blown up into my ears and so forth today, so I feel like I'm talking in a tunnel. That was because of the, you know, air travel. And so when we think about how is the ego formed, it's not unlike the formation of an archipelago in the Pacific, that where tiny millions and billions of skeletal remains of crustaceous creatures are brought by tidal pools and adhere to each other until it forms a rock-hard substance in appearance, but is surrounded at all times by the great billows of the ocean. So too the human ego is a splinter of the psyche in which there are clusters of experience that begin at birth that adhere to each other and form a provisional sense of I, who I am, or at least who I think I am. And the ego is a necessary complex. It's the central complex of consciousness. The ego worked very well for us today. It got us all to the same place at the same time. Less well-functioning egos are still lost out there in the traffic or attending the Freudian group tonight. But here we are. It's tasked with intentionality, with the work of consciousness, with continuity, with choice, with ethics, and so forth. It's a very important thing. But the ego also, at some level, understands its fragility and how vulnerable it is to other forces from the external world or from the internal world. And therefore, one of the ways it's dealt with this historically is through denial or through inflation. A hubris or pride or arrogance or self-delusion has always been a capacity of the ego, perhaps at times necessary to allow us to function in the face of the immensity of life. But nonetheless, it means that other portions of our psychological reality, which again are not present to consciousness and may be inimical to the values that we wish to affirm, are often pushed into the shadowy regions. And so the shadow again represents whatever within me is uncomfortable to me about me. This can include, thank you very much, this can include some of my best parts, some of my best energies, the so-called positive shadow, but more about that later. And another reason, too, is the ego is continuously having to defend itself against anxiety, ambivalence, and ambiguity. And so one of the ways in which we do that is denial. Another is rationalization, as the speaker did in the poem, Darwinian pieties, right? Once you have a philosophy, you can justify anything. And there is, of course, a necessary socialization of the child. We all learn appropriate oughts and shoulds. There is a place for the social contract. We stop at the stop signs and we count on our neighbor to do the same thing. That's appropriate. We learn to use a knife and fork. Now, at the same time, as Freud pointed out, the origins of neuroses is also found in the birth of civilization, where a human being then is obliged to serve divergent agendas. The agenda of instinct, which is hopefully grounded and healthful, and the agenda of culture. Now, when they are consonant with each other, we feel a sense of harmony. The more divergent they are, the deeper the split within us, which is the birth of neurosis. You can see that mirrored in the early stories of all people, the splitting of consciousness and the feeling of separation from the ground of being. In the Genesis story, for example, in Eden, there are two trees. One, from one tree you may eat and the other is forbidden. The tree of life you may participate in, that's the tree of instinct. But the tree of knowledge or consciousness is splitting and separating. And once one has eaten that fruit, one can no longer, in a sense, live unconsciously or wholly naively or completely as a child. So the more we try to exclude these deeper realities, the deeper the split within each of us. And therefore, what happens to the shadow? It becomes more and more autonomous. The things we don't know about or we're not taking responsibility for have the greatest play in our life. They have the greatest authority, whether we acknowledge it or not. And typically, the way in which we begin to deal with the shadow is, again, because of the painful consequences of patterns in our lives or how they spill into relationships and harm those whom we profess to love, or show up collectively in a divergence between the aims of our groups or our society and the outcomes that occur. Now, Jung said this about the shadow, and I quote, "Everyone carries a shadow, and the less it's embodied in the individual's conscious life, the denser it is. If an inferiority is conscious, one has a chance to confront it. Furthermore, when it's constantly in contact with other interests, then it can be subjected to modifications. But if it's repressed and isolated from consciousness, it never gets corrected and is likely to burst forth suddenly in a moment of unawareness. At all accounts, it forms an unconscious snag, thwarting our most well-meant intentions." Well, that's pretty clear. When this book, Why Good People Do Bad Things, came out about 2 years ago, America was preoccupied with very large social issues. It wasn't Iraq, it wasn't the economy, it wasn't the oncoming election, it was why did Britney Spears cut her hair in public? And also, why did the astronaut drive from Houston to Florida to whack her rival? So the publisher arranged a number of radio interviews, about 45 to be exact. And I would say of the 45, 30 people asked specifically about that. And the tone was very revealing. Tell us about those people. Tell us about them. Those the people that are maybe in a position of apparent privilege but do crazy things. Tell us about them. Because the implication was, therefore, we can separate who we are from who they are. Or at best, we can understand the mechanics of their craziness. And I said in my normal perverse Jungian way, well, we never do crazy things. We do logical things based on the emotional premises that are at work within us. Premises that may be inaccurate, often are unconscious, but our behaviors are conscious manifestations of those premises. So if a pop star, for example, in a very public and humiliating way, embarrasses herself, part of what that's about is a kind of autonomy of the psyche that's in revolt, that's trying to deconstruct a false image. There's something inside of that person that's saying, you know, the bubble you live in, this privileged world of the celebrity, is also an imprisonment. It's a pathology. There's no air in here. One has to tear it down, even as there are other parts of her psyche that would cling to the privileges that come with it. Or there are those around who profiteer from the exploitation of a person. And why should the public even be concerned about what someone else like this does? Why should there be newspapers like this at the end of the checkout counter in our supermarkets? What does that say about us, that we would even care about what a celebrity thinks or does? Is that not some kind of shadow issue itself? Or when we look at the astronaut, I was actually asked, if you believe this or not, by Newsweek magazine, why can't NASA work out tests to find crazy people up front? Seriously, the question was serious. And well, the truth is, we're all crazy, right? None of us could be astronauts. And I would say, who among us has not done something really foolish in our history in the name of love? Okay? Anyone here? All right? And of course, it wasn't in the name of love. It was in the name of anxiety about losing the beloved object. And there's a German phrase, Liebeswahn, love madness. Everyone's been intoxicated by love madness in one form or another. And we recognize in those moments, shadow material emerges. And if we think of the human personality as a large mansion with many rooms, the ego only gets consciously into a few of those rooms. There's so many there. But fate or the consequences of time and tides and the choices of others will push us into rooms we didn't know were there. And in every one of our mansions, there is a room with a deserted child. And the most logical thing for the deserted child is to act in a panicky way. So when we look at these examples, we begin to realize, all right, not only is there a shadow at work in the life of these people, there's shadow in the life of people who even care about such matters, or more importantly, would want to know how we can distance ourselves from them when we are in some way them as well. Dostoevsky wrote once, he said, the surest sign of our own sanity is that we wish to place our neighbor in an asylum. And so we realize here that there is always a kind of a recrudescence, you know, of the shadow. It's going to show up. Remember over Jung's entrance to his home in Küsnacht, he inscribed in Latin, called or not called, God will be there. Well, called or not called, the shadow will be there. And it's present here, of course. And Jung gave Freud a great deal of credit for exploring the shadow world. When you think about titles from just 100 years ago, The Psychopathology of Everyday Life in 1905. In other words, he said you don't have to go to a sequestered asylum to find psychopathology. You can find it by just tracking yourself for 24 hours. Or I think it was 1907, 101 years ago, Jokes in the Relationship to the Unconscious, in which he showed humor can often be a means of escaping the social contract, escaping the normal bounds of conscious life, and express scatological motives or aggressive motives. It can be violent, destructive. And yet, we can always say, well, can't you take a joke? You see? Or on the collective level, Freud wrote about 20 years later, civilization and its discontents, as he saw Europe tearing itself apart. His own son, Martin, wounded on the battlefields of the Great War. So there's a much exploration there of the shadow world. Not to mention the leakage of the forbidden into our symptomatology, our so-called Freudian slips, our dreams. As Freud said, they deny my theories by day but dream them at night. And particularly the exploration of things like infantile sexuality and so forth, which made early psychoanalysis appear very scandalous. You know, Freud's basic anthropology is very illustrative in this regard. You've heard of the id, the ego, and the superego. In the German, original German, it was much clearer. But when it was translated into English, it was written literally for physicians at the time, not the general public, and used the Latinate of that time that appeared to be scientific, because it was a language of science. But in German, it was much clearer. Das Es meant the itness of life. That's nature naturing. It's not good, it's not bad, it's just nature naturing. Das Überich is that which hangs over me. That's the oughts and shoulds, the culture's voice, mom and dad. And then there's das Ich, I, who I think I am at any given moment. And I'm in trouble here because I have to run back and forth between these competing parties, trying to keep them both happy. And I'll never be able to do it as completely as one would like. And that leads to the nervous Nelly of the ego. Excuse me. So when we begin to look at the shadow, and remember it's the thing I do not wish to be, as Jung said, we also have to recognize that there are many elements that get pushed into the underground that represent maybe the most vital and dynamic aspects of our personality. Ask yourself, what happened to the childhood imagination? Our spontaneity, our lack of fear in expressing ourselves, our capacity to sort of know what we liked and didn't like. Where did those things go? And where did they get lost in the thousand adaptations that arise in the course of one's socialization? So one of the biggest and most overlooked aspects of the shadow, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow afternoon, is the natural self that somewhere along the line became not affordable anymore, became too costly, whether it was the message of the family of origin or the immediate culture or religious training or educational system or the culture. It became in a certain way costly. And so one gets allied against the most vital and deeply connected parts of oneself. As T.S. Eliot said in one of his plays, in a world of fugitives, the person going the right way will appear to be running away. So then it's the natural self that often is loaded with the shadow burden when it is, in a sense, our healthiest part altogether. Now, typically, shadow areas would involve things like greed, violence, sexuality, and we can understand that each one of those, to some degree, can represent a threat to the established order, to the needs of society. And as I've already said, society has a right to make certain claims upon us. At the same time, these are aspects of our humanness. Perhaps the most profound thing ever uttered psychologically and philosophically and perhaps religiously by a human being was from the Latin poet or dramatist Terence 21 centuries ago, who said, "Nothing human is alien to me. Nothing human is alien to me." Now, that's a profound psychological statement, because it means that the enemy that I'm allied against is already within the gates, as it were. And I have to become more and more conscious of that. Now, there are various aspects of the way in which the shadow shows up. First of all, we have to talk about the personal shadow. That is to say, those elements that are unique to our lives and our particular history. Now, for all of us, because we share certain general cultural influences, we would have aspects of shadow which are we hold in common. But for many of us, there are unique aspects of our shadow, certainly. And there we began to appreciate as well the role of what Jung called the complex, because there's an entire, shall we say, shadow government that runs our personalities. And one of the things we'll talk about tomorrow is that one profound shadow issue is a good part of our daily behaviors are motivated by fear management, not by the necessarily healthy goals or ideals that the ego thinks it's in service to, but really fear management. That's not a federal crime. That just happens to be part of our human fragility. The role of this, of the complexes represents, again, autonomous centers within us, which temporarily usurp the ego and make choices for it. That's what produces the patterns. And it's disconcerting to realize how little, in the course of any single day, any part of us might be free and as much capable of choice as we think it is. There's also the collective shadow. The collective shadow shows up wherever individuals are gathered, wherever there's a group, wherever there's an abstraction like a nation or an ethnic group. The larger the group, potentially the larger the shadow. In fact, Jung said the level of consciousness tends to go down the larger the group it is. so that we understand something about the nature of mob psychology or mass psychology, or how people can be possessed by a profound complex in the culture and not even know it. I used to live in the Philadelphia area, and one of the sayings there was, well, the Quakers came to Philadelphia in the 18th century to do good, and they did very well indeed, thank you. So we can see that the best of motives can always have another agenda as well. And our favorite whipping post through the last decades, and for understandable reason, of course, was Nazi Germany, where we asked the question, isn't it awfully hot in here, by the way, don't you think? Okay, I thought it was maybe just me, but it's, I don't know what we can do about that. If it's possible to lower the heat a little bit, I'd appreciate it. Thank you. It's so easy to say, how could those people do that? This was the most advanced civilization on the planet at the time. And yet, again, the roots were always there. In the 19th century, the German poet Heinrich Heine wrote, he said, a nation that burns its books will soon be burning its people. And Heine is considered crazy, you see. But a century before, and you can read the prophecies, so to speak, in the other great sensitive, intuitive artists of the 19th century, such as Dostoevsky and Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and others. And we in America have been taught in our schools and our civic lore that we wear the white hat in history's melodrama. Well, not necessarily to the rest of the world. If we ask others in the world how they experience this, they'll start talking many times about our shadow. And we'll find that disconcerting, which is why many Americans don't ask. We find ourselves a culture that had an ideology called manifest destiny, which meant essentially the annihilation of indigenous populations, the consequences of which we're still living with. We're a society that institutionalized slavery for a good part of its history. We're a society that has ravaged nature, the consequences of which are still washing up on our shore. We are a culture that in recent years institutionalized torture as an agency of national government policy and then lied about it. So when we ask ourselves, how pure are we? How innocent are we? And why is it we don't raise our children to be able to look more critically at who we are, what our history has been, and what are the choices that we have before us, and how do we go about making those choices? Now, in the 19th century, there were two great groups that had a view of what America was about, and each had something profound to offer. On the one hand, you had the people like Emerson and Whitman and Thoreau and so forth, and the whole transcendentalist movement. And a few years ago in the summer, I taught Thoreau's Walden at the Houston Jung Center, and I hadn't read it since college. And it was fascinating to reread it, and it's still filled with stirring phrases and very idealizing comments. This time, however, reading it literally 30 or 40 years later, I kept saying, and what about the shadow here? And of what are we unconscious when we say that? And it was very interesting that in his first chapter, which I'd totally forgotten, it's the longest chapter there, it's called Economics. And I thought, well, you know, this is rural Massachusetts in the 1840s. He must be talking about home economics or breeding cattle or something. And he meant economics, how an abstraction was beginning to take over a culture. Nonetheless, the whole transcendentalist movement also in some way was finessing the shadow, was nonetheless trying to find a way to transcend it. On the other hand, the other strain in 19th century American literature, for example, are the ones that I think have had greatest staying power. They're the Hawthornes, the Melvilles, the Poes, the Twains. Hawthorne, every single short story he wrote, every one and every novel, had as its essential subject matter the shadow. And Melville, too, to a somewhat lesser degree, but still very much present. When you think of Moby Dick, you remember, for example, where's the evil? You see, all the evil is projected onto a natural being, the whale, who is, after all, white. He's a blank tablet, a slate. Where's the evil? It's in Ahab. Ahab is the monomaniacal 19th century American who will achieve at all costs. Or the stories of Poe are shadow-ridden. Twain used humor as a savage scalpel to lance pretension. Twain who said once, "Please, please don't tell my mother that I write about politics. She thinks I play the piano at a brothel." But these people had their finger on the real pulse of this expansionary ego in the 19th century, which continued into the 20th. And by the inflationary ego, the whole notion that the service of empire is the service of the good. And there are many, many other examples. Just think of Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground, which really punctures modern concepts of progress, written in 1863. And 1898, Conrad's The Heart of Darkness, showing how the European culture brought, quote, civilizing influences to darkest Africa, when, in fact, as Conrad writes, underneath you could always hear the whisper of gold and ivory, gold and ivory. If those natural elements had not been there, Europe would not have been there. So I could give further examples, but I think you get the point. Now, there are four basic modalities of the shadow, that is to say, how it manifests. By far, most of the time, it manifests unconsciously. We literally do not know we are in the grips of other aspects of our personality that we would wish to deny. So we're at the mercy then of autonomous invasions of the shadow. And this is, again, a common recognition. In the letter to Romans, Paul writes, "Though I know the good, I do not do the good." Why? Well, his answer is sin. And one of the words he uses is hamartia, which can be translated as a flaw. You know, it's a flaw in our character, or akrasia, that's a kind of moral lassitude. One of the things we know today that Paul didn't know is the incredible variegation of the human psyche. That there are many discrete dynamic elements that are present, not just the ego. So it's not just the failure of will, it's the presence of other active agencies that we need to be mindful around. That the whole psychodynamic view of the psyche is that it's polyvalent, that it's multi-centered, multi-dimensional. And all of these pieces are active at the same time. When Paul asks the question, why do we not do the good? The answer is because the human psyche is divided. It is quite separated. It's always diverse. And it's only the delusion of the ego that this aggregate of complexes is under our control. It's, in other words, we are more than we think we are in any given moment. And we never know enough to really know enough. And that's part of our psychological trap. Another way of putting this is certain parts of the personality have not yet been introduced to other parts of the personality, and when they are introduced, they're not going to get along very well. It's kind of like a squabbling family. So one recognizes here in the first place that the unconscious is by definition unconscious. That gives it its greatest power in our lives. A second modality of the unconscious is the energy that it embodies and the motive of the ego to disassociate from its agenda results in a projection. In other words, it leaves us and enters the world. It goes on to other people or groups or agencies or ideologies. And the scapegoating manifestation is one obvious form of that, and that's one finds that in all cultures, certainly. And in some cases, like Yom Kippur, efforts to make that conscious, at least periodically, or the idea of confession, to acknowledge one's presence in the world in quite sort of contradictory ways. So when we think of projection, we don't say in the morning, "Well, I think I'll have a projection today." It's unconscious. It leaves us and enters the world. We'd only become conscious of it when the other, over time, fails to carry through and live up to his or her part or its role, and we begin to, of course, the easy thing to do is blame them for that, as we do in relationships. "You're not the person I thought you were." And only when these chickens come home to roost is there ever a chance of recognizing that there was a projection going on there. So projections occur continuously, individually, and collectively, and they lead to bigotry, racism, ultimately to pogroms and Holocaust. The end station of projection of the shadow is the Holocaust. A third modality of the shadow is to get caught up in it and to enjoy it, to be possessed by it, and to revel, perhaps, or be energized by it. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Okay? Over 50% of the gross annual product of Louisiana is the French Quarter of New Orleans. You see? Which lives basically by titillating the shadow. And as such, has a very dynamic part in their economy. Now, Jung gave the example once of a banker, excuse me a second, a Swiss banker who came to him for some purpose and some therapeutic purpose. And after looking at his dreams for a while, the banker suddenly said to Jung, "Well, I'm really a scoundrel after all, rather than this epitome of Swiss rectitude. I'm really a scoundrel." And Jung said he didn't come back and he disappeared over the Alps with the bank funds. So here's a person who got caught up in the shadow and sort of subsumed by it. Or another example, I saw a young man years ago who was late 20s and had decided after selling cars for a while that he was going to go to seminary, become a clergyman. And so he thought it would be appropriate to get to know himself better, which certainly sounds reasonable. And in the first session, when I asked about some of his motivation or sense of calling, he said, "For one thing, it will please my parents." And I said, "Well, that sounds like a very compelling complex, but it's not necessarily a calling. Why don't you pay attention to your dreams, see what they have to say?" And the second session, he brought a dream in which he was involved with somebody whom he only knew from a distance, he didn't know personally, in some sort of nefarious scheme of sort of bilking people and manipulating them and so forth. And he was quick to take the ego's position there and say, "Well, look at that person." And I said, "But notice the psyche has put the two of you in league with each other, and you're carrying out the same project." And I said, "What is it about that person?" And he said, and at that moment, the scales fell from his eyes, and he said what he really enjoyed was manipulating people. It had first led him to selling cars, and then was going to lead him to organized religion. And then he said, "I can't go to seminary. I have to go to law school." See? That's a true story. But you see, the paradox is, having seen it, one could also say, "Now I know I really have something profound to deal with." And ultimately, that person could make a very appropriate clergyman if he could be able to work with the shadow, because that's where a lot of the work will occur. So sometimes we get caught in it and enjoy it. The fourth modality is for it to become conscious and for us to take responsibility for it, which sounds easy, but the point is, by definition, it's not easy. If it was easy, it wouldn't be shadow material. In other words, its contradictory nature makes it not easy, which is why we indulge in denial and projection and rationalization. In fact, every time we find quick rationalizations, we often find a defense of the shadow rather than accepting and becoming conscious of it. To make the shadow conscious is not to get rid of it, but it's to dialogue with it. Let me give you an example. 3 weeks ago today at the Jung Center in Houston, a colleague of mine gave a very fine workshop for therapists. And one of the things they were dealing with in that particular session, many, many subjects, but one of them was the erotic transference. What happens when the patient falls in love with the therapist? And everyone quickly said, "Well, you tell them very quickly that's not appropriate here. It's got to be safe here." But the colleague of mine said, "Yes, but the real point is the place also has to be safe for psyche, for the reality of those feelings, And the reality of that part of our psychological reality, it has to somehow be honored or respected before it can ever really be integrated into anything worthwhile. And I thought that was a very wonderful way of looking at, you know, a shadow issue. That to assimilate something into consciousness doesn't mean it goes away. It means one has to say, here's something else now I have to be mindful around. I have to be particularly aware of in this kind of situation or these circumstances. This other kind of agenda will have a tendency within me to show up. And that's an enlargement of consciousness. And interestingly enough, one of the byproducts of that kind of work will become less judgmental of others. We'll become less rigid in our morality. We'll be far more humbled by this. It's not inflationary. It's not aggrandizing. It's humbling. That's another reason why we don't want to do it. As Jung said, one does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness visible. This is quite different, isn't it, to make it visible. But he says this procedure is very disagreeable, therefore not practiced very much. So again, one sees that we all have ways of trying to finesse the shadow. Now often in small towns, if there is a bookstore where you can find any book by Jung, it's going to be a so-called New Age bookstore. And New Age culture has produced many good things. A greater appreciation of the so-called feminine energy, a reappraisal of our relationship to nature. In fact, a reappropriation of the idea of spirit itself in a materialist culture in which we're all awash. At the same time, underneath so much of New Age culture is an effort to finesse the shadow, to finesse conflict, to finesse suffering, to have transcendence without depth or without descent, first of all. You can't have the anabasis without the katabasis. You can't have the ascent without the descent. And often to find gurus, because one of the shadow issues is the flight from personal responsibility in all of this. No one else is here to tell us what to do with our lives. We're here to figure it out for ourselves. And any flight from that responsibility is a profound shadow. Now, this is not always easy work or pleasing work, as I've said. Let me give you what I hope you will hear as a mildly humorous example. You know, when they warn you in advance, it's supposed to be funny. It's really not going to be funny, you know. It's based on a true story, a true incident about 2 years ago. It's called Marital Bliss. Waking from a dream on a Sunday afternoon, I slung my arm over my wife. She who once defined relationship as, quote, having one special person to annoy for a very long time. And I asked her if she would marry me again. Uh-huh, she said. And I said, I thought you would pause longer, reflect, savor the moment. I was being polite, she said. So don't ask if you're not prepared to hear, okay? So, again, back to Terence. Nothing human is alien to me. So then I have to deal with the improbable possibility that there could be a kind-hearted person in me, a charitable person, maybe even a saint hiding somewhere, whatever a saint may be, alongside the aggressor, the murderer, the lecherer, the thief, the liar. The whole crowd is there. We are the carriers, genetically and archetypally, of the human story. Why is it that we would be above that? We are it. We are swimming in it at all times. So wherever we are unaware, it's going to show up in our relationships. It's going to show up in our world. It's going to show up in our children. So you see, the shadow work is the single best way we can start cleaning up our own backyard. Jung spoke to this very succinctly and very clearly in his 1937 Terry Lectures at Yale in New Haven, Connecticut, and I'll quote that paragraph. He said, our ordinary psychological life is swimming with projections. You can find them spread out in the newspapers, books, rumors, and ordinary social gossip. All gaps in actual knowledge are still filled with projections, We are still certain we know what other people think or what their true character is. We are convinced that certain people have all the bad qualities that we do not know in ourselves. We have to be exceedingly careful not to project our own shadows shamelessly. If you could imagine someone brave enough to withdraw these projections, then you would get an individual conscious of a pretty thick shadow. Such a person has saddled himself with new problems and conflicts because he's become a serious problem to himself. Because he's no longer able to say, they do this or that, they are wrong, they must be fought. Such a person knows that whatever is wrong in the world is in himself. And if he only learns to deal with his own shadow, then he's done something real for the world. He succeeded in removing an infinitesimal part of the unsolved gigantic problems of our day. How could anyone see straight when one does not even see oneself and that darkness that we carry into all our dealings? So that's Jung. Now, a couple of other thoughts about the shadow, and then we'll take a 5 or 10 minute break, and then we'll come back for your comments and questions. When we look at the cultural context in which we live, we see over the past few decades that there is much of the shadow. We live in a culture that's driven by fear, for example. We live in a culture that has diverted its spiritual journey, by and large, into materialism and into sensation. We live in a culture that is drug-induced most of the time. Perhaps worst of all, we live in a culture that is fueled by triviality. You know, the largeness of the human soul is diminished. I think, and this is a very prejudiced statement, but I'll stand by it, that the absolute abandonment of a psychodynamic approach to the human experience by most of the professional community and almost all of academia is a profound failure of nerve to take on large questions. That the single most important psychological issue of our time is the single most important spiritual issue, because they're one and the same. What does it mean to be who I am, and what is my journey about? And any flight from that kind of magnitude or order of question, I think, is an insult to the soul and a trivialization. Now, foremost among this is so much of pop psychology. And it's not only formal psychology, but pop psychology and also pop theology. If you go to many bookstores today, the psychology section has disappeared. If there's anything resembling it, it'll be called typically self-help. Now, I'm not opposed to the self-helping. I believe that sometimes the self has a great help to offer to us. But you understand what that's about. When you look at the titles, it's 30 days to this or that, 5 easy steps to this, how you can have the perfect relationship, etc. And you read them, and it's all superficial, with very, very few exceptions. Very few exceptions. And again, a kind of abandonment of the magnitude of the human story. The necessity of suffering, the necessity of ambiguity, the difficulties of getting anything to work over time, the importance of choosing one's values and being willing to stand for them, the importance of threading one's way through the thicket of stimuli around us to find one's own truth, to find one's own personal authority. All of these things, which we know to be profoundly the case, are not to be found in pop psychology. On the other hand, in terms of pop theology, we find two great wings, and this is where, and again, I'm not criticizing anyone's right to belief. That's far from my purpose here. I believe strongly in the First Amendment to the Constitution. But we also see a flight from depth in so much popular theology. On the one hand, you have those theologies that emphasize sin and redemption that ultimately wind up infantilizing people. They make them afraid. They produce parental surrogates who usurp the authority from them. And in the end, they will produce only failure. Because since I can never maintain strictly the moral course that's set before me, I will end up either blaming the deity or turning it back upon myself. Either of which I think is a mistake. And so we have that whole wing of a sort of religious culture that in the end infantilizes people and makes them children. And on the other hand, you have that wing that essentially ratifies people's complexes. I live about 2.5 miles from America's largest church. 25,000 people per service every Sunday. It's a small city. There are armies of buses taking people there, okay? It professes to be a Christian denomination, but there isn't a single cross in the entire facility. And when asked, it's because we don't want people to have disturbing thoughts. So I'm not making this up. And the group is so large that they had to buy the sports arena to be larger, and then to expand it. Now, again, basically the message there is you can have what you want. Get right with God and you can have what you want. Now, if that isn't ego-based, if that isn't complex-driven, is it anything that brings a person into genuine encounter with the magnitude of the human soul? Again, I'm not criticizing people's right to believe. That's not my point. If anything, I'm criticizing, it's those who purvey these points of view and profiteer from it. But underneath this, we have a kind of, again, infantilization or trivialization of the human spirit. And that's one of the biggest shadow issues of our time. We have grave problems, as you know. We have new beginnings. The problems may perhaps be insoluble in terms of how we would have wished them to be seen from the past. But we have to have a greater level of consciousness as we approach these issues. And when we do, we realize that we can't afford to be trivial. A friend of mine wrote a poem that was in response to a letter or review of one of my earlier books that was on Amazon.com. And this person took me to task for my vocabulary and other such problems and suggested that I get a ghostwriter. So she wrote this and sent to me as an email, and I'll just share this with you. She said, I read the reviews posted at Amazon.com by Inner Seeker, and may I recommend a ghostwriter for you, Dr. Seuss of Green Eggs and Ham. And here's how Dr. Seuss might do it. I am Jim, Jim I am, I'll fix you up, my little lamb. Having troubles with midlife, no longer like your aging wife. You do not like this older life, you do not like the family strife. I can cure you, yes I can cure you, Jim I am. No need to be more mature, a trophy wife is the cure. Or if a gal you happen to be, a nip, a tuck, a surgeon's fee, youth wasted on the young no longer be. If the problem is your work, the blankety-blank demanding boss is such a jerk, quit now, you idiot, don't delay, is he not the problem anyway? I can cure you, yes I can cure you, Jim I am. It won't take long from me to you, just a couple of days, and we'll be through. No pain, no growth, no work are needed, just the answers to life as hordes have pleaded. I'll make life good, I promise you'll see. Just follow instructions, 1, 2, 3. I can fix you, yes I can fix you, Jim I am. Well, this actually has merit. It might sell books. Well, shadow work, and I'll say this for the last time, then we'll take a break. Shadow work obviously is not going to make you feel great about yourself. It's in fact humbling. It'll make you more human. It'll make you less a danger to those around you. That might be a virtue. It often leads us to have to revise our understanding of self and others. But not doing this work is far, far worse. It reminds me of a poem by a Swedish poet who is being shown the wonders of a big city by someone who is boasting about its accomplishments. And he's walking around looking at all these buildings and all of the monuments and so forth, and he says, I see. So the slums must be inside of you. Well, There are cities and slums inside of each of us. Interesting places to visit. And if we don't visit them, they'll visit us. Let's take a 5-10 minute break, and then we'll come back for your comments and questions. Thank you. Please. This will be an opportunity for your comments and questions and protests. I'm sitting up here now for two reasons. One, because I can sit, and this way it's easier to see each other. And secondly, one of the reasons I'm so hot is these are big vents right below here. Only when I stepped away did I realize that my backside was getting burned. So not only was there knocking in the basement, but there were backdrafts from behind. So I think those are compelling metaphors. Now is the opportunity for your comments and questions and thoughts. Please.
I'm curious to get your thoughts about how the shadow played in this recent election and in this transition from one president to another.
Okay. Actually, I want to shy away from any specific political comments because that becomes too easy in a way, but to say shadow is always there, and I know this is going to sound horribly reductionistic, but let's at least consider its prospects. You can't go broke betting on the role that anxiety plays in people's lives. So much of our daily life, and I mean this quite literally, is about anxiety management, and there's nothing wrong with that per se, because you know we are fragile, vulnerable, sentient beings, and then we die. So, you know, have a nice day. So it's our existential condition that it's perilous, literally. It's lethal. But in addition to that, as we know, core experiences get wrapped around anxiety pockets, which produce compensatory behaviors. In fact, tomorrow in our workshop, I'm going to start off by talking about some of the shadow systems that we have in our personalities. All of us have, and you should be able to see those shadow systems at work, and I won't go into them tonight. But the whole point is so much of conscious life is fueled by anxiety. And so whenever you have decisions to make, there's always going to be the arousal. If it's an important question of all, at all, it's going to arouse anxieties of one kind or another. And then that becomes prime breeding ground for the provoking of projections onto each other, a breeding ground for divisiveness, for polarizing, for splitting, good, bad, our people, their people, that kind of thing. And we really just have been through that. Now, I will have to say, and I don't want to veer into politics, I think those kinds of motives and strategies have specifically been the operative positions of the U.S. government for the last 8 years, which has had a profoundly divisive effect within this country and between this country and the rest of the world. So that for many people around the world, as you all know from the news, the recent elections were a recovery of an America that a lot of people would like to believe in, abroad as well as at home. So this doesn't dispel the shadow. It will continue to be there. Now, again, we have to remember, too, that the shadow involves our own capacity for magnanimity, generosity, cooperation, dialogue. I mean, even those values that the conscious mind embraces, in fact, can be threatening to our complexes and to our old archaic anxieties. So, you know, the really great news is that the system allowed a nonviolent transition of power, which is not to say there wasn't violence within. There was. But that's better than the violence spilling into the streets as it has in other cultures, in other times. And, you know, it's as Churchill said, it's a notoriously inefficient system, but it just happens to be better than all the rest. So, you know, I'm grateful tonight to be a part of that possibility, certainly. Now, that was a political answer to a political question, and I'm going to run for office next time. So, actually, I was in New Hampshire last November, and the Jung Society there was complaining every third person on the street, literally, this was in Concord, was either a candidate or a member of a candidate's staff. So while I was there, I modestly declared my pursuit of the presidency, and it didn't really lift off the ground particularly, but it was kind of fun. So, another comment or question, please.
Culture seems to be so anxious and so full about fear. In my lifetime, I've wondered about the loss of our rituals of grief and the emergence of a much stronger shadow. I'm wondering, as you think about the historical conditions of our culture and the historical conditions of indigenous cultures, how you would talk about embracing our shadows through the restoration of the work of grief our society?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I've never been asked that one. And if you perhaps couldn't hear in the back, he was talking about the way in which the historic rituals for grieving have, by and large, waned, and that how that whole theme can be sort of assuaged. You know, grief comes from the Latin word gravis, which means weight or heavy. We get the word gravity from that. Or gravid. Or grave. And so grief is what pulls us back to earth. And in many ways, we are a rootless culture. In many ways, we are a transient culture. Nothing lasts. And nothing's permanent. And therefore, very little can be of value. From the standpoint of popular culture, I'm not speaking of you as an individual, but I'm talking about the forces around us. And the failure to grieve is a failure to be honest. And ultimately, that will show up somewhere pathologically. Grieving is in proportion to the gift. Whatever is given, when it is lost, there is an appropriate honesty in its loss. So wherever grief is bypassed or short-circuited, it will show up as depression, as addictions that seek to numb the experience, or the trivialization of it through distractions. Tuesday of this week, by coincidence, if you're not familiar with our international Jung page, would be worth your knowing about it. It's www.cgjungpage, one word, cgjungpage.org. And there are tons of articles there and reviews, and societies are listed there. The Seattle Society is there and so forth. And just this week, I posted a brief review of two books by colleagues of mine on the death of children. And the issue of the psychology of grieving by coincidence and so forth. It was a year ago this week that my own son died in Santa Fe. So this has been a year of great grief for me. And so grief is a way, as I said, of valuing what is there. So not to value it is not to suffer its loss. And so I think part of the honesty of grief is the capacity to suffer. Now, I think grieving goes on all the time and often unconsciously. I mean, I think, for example, there is a deep unconscious grief in our estrangement from nature. I think there's a deep unconscious grief in our estrangement from the gods. And by the gods, I mean metaphorically the powers of the universe that our ancestors had living rituals that connected them, presumably, or at least images that bound them affectively to the transcendent order. There is grief around the loss of community. And so where do those emotions go if they're not brought into conscious observance. Again, they go out as projections, or they're buried in the psyche and will pathologize. In fact, you can say that's a pretty general principle that's right at the heart of shadow work. Whatever is not addressed will either wind up projected out there into the world, and we'll be looking for it at that place, not understanding that that's not what it's about, or it will internalize and show up in our bodies, our emotion, our dreams, our relationships, or whatever. So it's a very good question you ask, and as I've said, I've never quite been asked that question, not in the context of the shadow discussion, because it too can be a flight from depth, you see. And that's why the word grief really means wait. And wait in the sense of solidity, you see. And so the more we have of a kind of trivialization of the human spirit, so much so that we have to invent reality shows of all things, as if we don't have reality, that the more we live in that kind of world, the less connected we are to anything that is grounded. So grief will be forbidden in the new world in that regard, as well as other troubling emotions, ultimately, like love. Because it, too, is a great path of suffering. Lynn?
My favorite person in history is Lincoln, as I've told you before. And I was just wondering, do you see him as somebody who was able to, quote unquote, self-actualize with his many griefs, including the Civil War and his children? And I guess I see him as somebody who was able to do what you're talking about without having read about it.
Mm-hmm. Good question. Lynn's question was about Lincoln, whose bicentennial comes up in about 3 months. And I grew up in Springfield, Illinois, so that's Lincoln country, as you know. And my grandparents are buried very near Lincoln, literally. A matter of yards away. And Lynn's question was a person who bore so much without ever having read anything that we would call psychology. And was his path not a path of sort of natural individuation? And I would have to say, yes. And the more one learns about Lincoln, the more complex his spirit was, and the more tortured it was. There's a very interesting book out by Michael Burlingame called The Inner World of Lincoln. And in his introduction, he says, of all things, he said, I'm going to take a Jungian approach to Lincoln. And he said, because it's the only psychology that helps make any sense of him. And so I wrote to him. And it turns out, he said to me, first of all, he wanted to know if I had any Lincoln stories, you know, always the historian. And actually, I did have one. But he said that he was basing that on his own personal analysis as well. But in there, one sees, for example, that Lincoln, I could go on forever on this subject, you shouldn't have asked it, but this would be the short version. Lincoln grew up with a kind of too much mother and a not enough father, which is not an atypical pattern. And he had a kind of inordinate attachment to his mother and yet fear of her as well, which often go hand in hand. And he married a person who was very troubled and I think from all contemporary standards appears to have been bipolar in quite a literal sense. And there are stories, for example, that I never heard in Springfield, by the way, but where people would go along at night and Lincoln would be sleeping in a yard at 8th and Jackson. And people would say, what are you doing there, Abe? And he'd say, well, Mary's having one of her fits again. So here's the future president of the United States sleeping in the yard. But he was forever caught in trying to sort of assuage her, take care of her. She literally bankrupted the White House budget in terms of spending sprees that were probably during manic phases and so forth. And it's a very interesting and troubling story in itself. And later, she would never speak to their son, Robert, the only one to survive, because Robert had to place her involuntarily in a psychiatric hospital for her illness. There was no medication at the time. But his capacity to bear his own depression, he was clearly depressed all of his life. There's a whole chapter in there on his midlife crisis where he was very, very suicidal, saw no purpose to life. He'd lost his beloved of his youth, Anne Rutledge, and was as by his own view, a failure at everything he had tried, and had lost elections, and was very close to the edge of suicide. And there were friends who were coming around to make sure he didn't do it. And his favorite poem was something called On Melancholy, and he used to drive people crazy by reciting it aloud to them over and over and over. So he was a horribly depressed individual. And part of how he compensated for the depression was with a profound sense of humor. A great storyteller and a profound sense of humor that was his way of, I think, maintaining an inner psychic balance. But most importantly, seems to have been a person who was able to tolerate the tension of opposites. And the tension of opposites that can tear us apart inside can also tear us apart in the world out there. No one fought harder to preserve the Union. No one spoke better about the so-called better angels of our nature that were overthrown by shadow issues and the passions of the day. No one ever suffered more the horrors of the slaughters. 600,000 dead, 1 million casualties. And you know, they would bring the wagon trains of the wounded into Washington, and he would visit the hospitals. They allowed people to take pictures of our dead and wounded in that era, by the way, unlike current policy, because the magnitude of the suffering was something that he had to bear personally. And as he said, I tremble at the thought that our God is a just God, because it may be that we will have to suffer a casualty for every lash of the bondsman's lash on the back of a slave. That he saw that as the debt America owed that was somehow to be paid in blood. So he was a person of a deep and brooding melancholy, and yet a profound capacity, I think, to tolerate the tension of opposites and to find his way through and to make the best of it. I was watching CNN tonight, and they were saying that one of the books that has particularly impressed President-elect Obama is the book by Doris Kearns on Lincoln's cabinet. That one of the things he went out and did was brought in all of his election rivals and put them on the cabinet. And I suppose it was one way to keeping an eye on them, but it was another way of really trying to embrace the tension of opposites. And apparently our president-to-be is very much operating in that spirit as well. So, I would say that Lincoln was one of those persons who was on some sort of natural path of individuation, but not without his shortcomings and foibles, as we all have, including an overwhelming ambition. You know, something profound was driving him all that time. And self-taught, and rose to the highest office. And in a peculiar way, and I don't, again, mean this as a kind of invidious comparison, but a background not unlike the psychology of Richard Nixon. Same family dynamics, poverty, and so forth, creating a profound power complex. And for Nixon, that power complex, you know, drove him over the edge. It drove his administration over the edge. Enough was never enough. Winning a huge electoral majority was not enough. Power was not enough, because it was always in service to a large shadow complex that was saying they can always take it away from you. They did before, they can do it again. Setting in motion forces that brought about the complete overthrow of all that achievement. It's an interesting subject. Yes, sir.
In relation to the shadow, I was wondering if you would just make a comment on Jesus saying, I am the light of the world.
On Jesus is saying that I am the light of the world? Well, there's a difference between whoever Jesus was and whatever the Christ is. In the same way, there's a difference between Gautama, the person, and the Buddha. And as Jung said, each of them represented for their world a model of individuation. Not that you're to emulate their life, because they did that. It's been done. You're supposed to live your journey in the way they did. One for the East and one for the West. So to be the light of the world is not the imitatio Christi as aping the behavior of someone else. It's saying, find your path in relationship to whatever is transcendent to ordinary ego consciousness, both externally and internally. That there is, in a sense, a guiding energy, whether it comes from externally or internally or both. And the meeting point's the human psyche. That's for you to figure out. Someone else, please. Yes, right here.
You mentioned in one of your books, I think it was something about a lack of spirituality in Western culture. And I think I might be butchering this. And you went on to say that what has primarily replaced spirituality in our society is hedonism, narcissism, and materialism. Mm-hmm. And why is hedonism, narcissism, and materialism so pervasive in our culture?
Well, it's a very large question. Why is hedonism, narcissism, and materialism, which are the sort of de facto religions, and by that I mean, what is it that organizes more energy in service to what values? You could say, well, I'm a Quaker, I'm a Presbyterian, I'm a Catholic, I'm a Buddhist, I'm an agnostic, whatever I am. That's the conscious ego talking. Where the distribution of one's energies actually go is one's de facto spirituality. So speaking for the culture, not for you as an individual, that in a sense, what has happened over the last four centuries has been the progressive erosion of those dynamic images that once linked people to the four great orders of meaning. The first is to the cosmos. You know, this is the cosmological question. Why are we here? Where are we going? What are we supposed to do in the meantime? Who are the gods? That's a profound question. Secondly, the mystery of our environment. You know, the German word for environment is Umwelt. It means really to be wrapped in the world around me. And the linkage to the world of which I am a part. And what are the means by which we live harmoniously? And thirdly is the mystery of community. Who are my people? How do we differ from others? What responsibilities or claims can be made upon me as a result of that? What codes of ethics or values do we carry? What about interpersonal relationship? This is the relational or communal question. And fourth is the psychological question, and who am I? And what is my journey about? And what am I to do with my energies? Now, for an individual or a culture to have images that link one to those four orders of mystery, that person will have a sense of purpose, direction, a sense of being at home on this planet, and will have a sense of identity. Erode any one of those images, and you have an individual or a culture in trouble. Quick example. The book The Way to Rainy Mountain by N. Scott Momaday tells the story of his Kiowa history, his tradition, a tribe that rose out of the Rockies in 1790s, migrated to the high plains of Oklahoma and Texas, and perished by 1890. their tutelary spirit, their linkage to the gods was the bison. And so prayers before the hunt, the ceremony of the hunt, the thanksgiving afterwards, the utilization of the gift of the bison to us, of the hide, of the meat, of the bones for tools that would fuel a family for a year. And then its destruction, and with it the linkage to transcendence, and therefore the loss of the mythic center. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. That's Yeats in 1917. So what happened over the last several centuries is the erosion of the images that linked people to the mysteries and their progressive replacement by secular surrogates. I'm actually getting to your question. Now, an example being, and I'll choose Philadelphia because I used to live there. If you paddled your canoe up the Delaware River in 1776, the structure that would come over the horizon first is still there. It's the steeple on 2nd Avenue, the steeple of Christ Church Episcopal. If you paddled your canoe up the Delaware River, the structure that would come over the horizon first in 1876 is still there. It's an ugly Victorian building called City Hall, with a statue of William Penn, 22-foot statue of William Penn, welcoming the New World. If you paddle your canoe up the river today, what do you see? The Blue Cross Blue Shield building, AT&T building, the Prudential building. Notice the shift there from sacred institution to socio-political institution to a pure abstraction like economics. And so you ask, why is it that materialism, hedonism, and narcissism have become de facto spiritualities? Because they are replacing, poorly, obviously, traditional images. Jung specifically says that, notice that psychology was the last invented of the so-called social sciences at the end of the 19th century. The last invented. And why? Now think of it. Political science, as modern disciplines, political science, sociology, anthropology, gerontology, economics, all 19th century inventions. And he said the reason is because the mysteries that they seek to address heretofore were embodied in tribal mythology, namely the images of the gods, of nature, of tribe, and so forth. So with the progressive loss of linking images, and the word religion itself means to reconnect with, to bind back to, with the progressive loss of the power of those images to link people, then you have a large vacuum, and a spiritual vacuum that can be filled by almost anything. Jung addressed this specifically in 1939 in a speech to the Guild for Pastoral Psychology in London. And he said exactly that point. Humankind ill tolerates a spiritual vacuum. He said, in our time, the masses on the right are forming as Nazism or fascism, and on the left as communism. He said, they will produce cataclysmic conflict. He said, there's a third group of people in whom the future hope abides. And he said, they are the neurotic. That's us. In other words, who have internalize the conflict, the meaning conflicts, the meaning struggle. Because in the individual, there is the possibility of its working through. In the mass mind, never. So what we have today, rather than communism and fascism, although they linger in the world, are the modern secular alternatives. Materialism. The good life is found in owning things. Since I'm spiritually empty, the more things I can fill my life with, the richer I'll be, right? That's the thinking. And it's all about me anyhow, not my tribe. I don't have a tribe. And thirdly, it's about enjoying this life as much as you can and no grieving, and no melancholy, and no social service. Let's just enjoy the trip. Now, those are very seductive ideas. If they weren't, we'd live in a different culture. And one of the things that's happened to us, interestingly enough, in the recent weeks and months, is the deflation of a lot of that fantasy of bigger and better, and that our systems are working, and the systems will carry us. And it's a discordant time. You know, when the Roman Empire tumbled, Augustine had to write a whole treatise, The City of God. And because the world map was falling apart. The world order was disintegrating. He also had to write a treatise against suicide, because many believers thought, if heaven's a good place, let me get there sooner. Well, our world order has been shaken, if not shattered. And many of our systems have failed. We had a hurricane in Houston about, in September. And so many of us went without phones and power for many, many days. You'd be amazed at how many things you depend on electricity for. You'd be amazed. And at the same time, there was a pretty fine communal spirit that emerged, that actually re-emerged when people weren't living in their air-conditioned cocoons, but were actually out in their yards dealing with the common issues. So that's another story, but it's very complex. A whole weekend at least can be spent just beginning the discussion. One last comment. I've made the point elsewhere that the last time the Western world made sense was around 1320. And that was the time of the publishing of Dante's Commedia, the comedy. It's not a comedy in the modern sense. There's nothing funny about Dante. It's a comedy because it had a happy ending, namely salvation. And he's able to appeal to a three-storied universe, up there, down there, and this plane, and a world of cause and effect. This equals this through time and eternity. And in the context of stabilizing institutions, a monarchy that claimed both divine and secular sanction, and a church that claimed both divine and secular sanction, together forming the longitudes and latitudes of the time. Take away the longitudes and latitudes, and how do you know where you are? You don't. That authority has been evolving and eroding since 1320. And I could give you tons of examples. Just one other example. Goethe's Faust in 1800. Faust and Mephistopheles go on their magical mystery tour, the first place they go is the witch's kitchen. And the head witch says to Faust, "Squire Satan, it's great to see you. Been a long time." He says, "That name is out, hag. No more." He said, "The evil one," capital letters, "the evil one is gone. The evil ones remain." And that's the very clear birth of the modern experience. The dethronement of the guy in red underwear and pitchfork and horns. He's now on Deviled Ham, a certain North Carolina team. It's a comic figure. Has evil gone away? No. It's democratized. It's in the heart and soul of each of us. It's found in the people who maintain systems without applying consciousness, conscience, and reason to them. When Hannah Arendt goes to Jerusalem to see the trial of Eichmann, she goes expecting to see a monster, as if a tail will be protruding beneath his suit. She sees an ordinary person like us, a clerk, a civil servant, whose job was to keep the trains running, to solve problems of that kind, irrespective of the content on the trains. And then you realize what Goethe was on to 2 centuries ago. The evil one is gone, but the evil ones remain. So if you sort of demythologize the large powers, then you have to look for them in the human heart. One more question?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
In this context, could you say a few words about the concept of sacred place? I've been struck with the numbers of times that I've heard put it into a sentence. Don't tell me to go shopping. What can we sacrifice? I'm ready to sacrifice something for this country to make it better.
Yeah. Well, I'll just speak in general. Again, like the word question on grief, a very good one. Because sacrifice comes from the two Latin roots to sacred and to make sacred. Sacrifice is part of how the ego participates in the transcendent. And I think that's true for so many of us. It's a time for sacrifice, not just bigger and better, not the inflationary ego, not expansion, but rather sacrifice. Now, a culture is going to have to ask, what does that mean? Individuals are going to have to ask what that means. I'm not going to tell you what that means. It's something you have to figure out for yourself. Because sacrifice is one of the means by which one stands in relationship to the transcendent. It's also one of the means by which one reestablishes community. When you say you're willing to do that for your country, I think I've heard that from many people. And that is a very encouraging thought, because that's one of the necessities of any community. It's the opposite of that narcissism. Doesn't mean that narcissism is evil. It means it's part of our nature. The question is, when that part of our nature runs amok, what we have is what's been running Wall Street for all of these years. Absolute delusion and self-aggrandizement with zero accountability. So, you know, just as I'm about 3 miles from the world's biggest church, I'm also about 3 miles from the Enron buildings, one of which was just completed and never occupied. Big glass towers, big ones, really big ones, shiny glass. You can see them from the airport when the plane comes in. Now, again, a monument to a kind of leveraged artifice built on paper. One of the presidents of the Houston Jung Center was a lawyer who was fired by Enron because he told them their system was illegal. So they didn't want to listen to that. So their shadow, isn't it? And it was the sixth largest American corporation in its apex. And it was all based on paper. If you and I said this to somebody, you know what I'm going to do? Rather than pay you what I owe you, I'm just going to establish these other little entities out here. And I'm going to refer my debt out here. And so it won't be on my income tax at the end of the year or my balance sheet. Well, we would call you dishonest. We would call that a fraud, wouldn't we? But the best and brightest were working the system. And some of them were my neighbors. And before I sit in judgment, let's just say the fraud is within me as well. That's the whole point of the shadow. Any of us can at any time be subject to motives and values that we would otherwise repudiate. That's the whole idea of the shadow. It's humbling. It requires a measure of self-examination, a disciplined self-examination, and a willingness to try to be honest. Again, this is the single best thing we can do for the world, is dump less of our stuff upon it. Now, we have some announcements, I believe, from John, who's here somewhere. Here he is. Thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.